Hello and welcome to the Good Mood Podcast. My name is Dr. Talia Marcagiani. I'm a naturopathic doctor and I have dedicated my practice to learning everything there is to know about optimizing mental and emotional health. In this podcast, we answer the question, what does it take to live a life of truth, beauty, freedom, vitality, purpose, and joy? In a mix of solo episodes and interviews, I'll be talking about all the things that fascinate me, nutrition, nature, the latest science, psychology and psychotherapy, mindfulness and meditation, supplementation, and more. I'm so excited to have you here. In this episode, we're going to do something a little bit different. I talked to Dr. Anne Hussain, naturopathic doctor, menstruation guru, PCOS solver, and period literacy advocate, back to back with two interviews. In the first interview, I interviewed Dr. Anne, and then she flips the script and interviews me. As you know, I'm super interested in the intersection between our mental health and hormones. This is one of the topics that fascinates me the most in my clinical practice. Hormones are really cool, as we discussed in these two interviews. They orchestrate how we feel physically and mentally. Our moods are subservient to our hormonal states, and learning how to honor these hormones is so important for living in accordance with nature and our body's rhythms. In these two interviews, we talk about all kinds of juicy topics, self-care, including Anne's awesome self-care grid, the relationship between hormones and mood, what a typical cycle looks like hormonally, and how that can influence your mental health, and the effect of the birth control pill on our hormones, moods, and mental health, and why it's super important to make informed choices when it comes to your body, your brain, and your hormones. So enjoy. Hello, everybody. I'm Dr. Talia Marcagiani, and I am joined by Dr. Anne Hussain, who's my colleague and fellow naturopathic doctor. So, Anne, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I am a naturopathic doctor, as you mentioned. I practice in Aurora, Ontario. I am all about menstrual health and infertility. So I work a lot with women between the ages of 18 and 50, talking about their periods, optimizing their periods, and like the three overarching kind of themes of my practice end up being self-awareness, self-compassion, and self-advocacy. I personally have a history of PCOS, and that was a diagnosis that was missed for so long. So I'm really about all about like keeping track of what's happening in your body so you can advocate better for yourself.
Cool. This is really cool. And it's cool that you apply those three concepts, which you could essentially apply to everything health related.
Yeah. Or in your life, really. Yeah.
How do you see, I'm curious about the self-compassion part of the period, of period health. Like, how do you apply that, or how does that show up in the work?
So self-compassion kind of, for me, it's not just self-compassion, it's also like self-care. Mm. It's also like, it's, you know, this overarching concept. So self-compassion as in when which I do a lot of period literacy work. So I'm teaching women about the hormonal changes that are happening in their cycles. And we're never taught this idea of, you know, a fluctuating state of being, right? Because your hormones are doing kind of this dance throughout your cycle. But we're taught that, you know, you should do this on a daily basis, but we don't necessarily feel like this every day. Like, we're fluctuating as well, especially with the hormonal shifts. So for example, during the period, there's some blood loss. The first couple of days can be a little bit low energy. And then as we move toward ovulation after that, energy typically rises, motivation rises, people feel better, they feel the most like themselves. That's what I hear from patients. And I can attest to that too. Like, I feel my best and I am able to do more of the productive work and more of the planning and taking action sort of thing in that phase between, you know, day three of my cycle, day one being my period, and then all the way until, you know, a week before my period, which is when, you know, the hormones do this downward dip. And usually that's the time for me to rest more. So I might push myself a little bit more in the middle of my cycle, and at the end of my cycle, I might be like, okay, I'm not feeling it, instead of, you know, just fighting against the lowered energy or just like the mood changes. I'm going to lean into that and then move forward. So that's kind of what we're talking about when talking about having that capacity to tailor your self-care activities and also showing yourself compassion if you're not feeling up to it, because there are hormonal changes that are happening.
I love that. Yeah, it's kind of like this idea of when I'm putting cocoa powder in everything I'm eating to be aware of where I am in my cycle and to, like you said, lean into it and just say, like, this is a time when everything needs to be chocolate.
So, yeah, for sure. And there's actually solid research that if you want to change habits or create habits, the follicular phase is the time to do it. So the first half of your cycle, that's when you want to do it because you have this increase in follicle stimulating hormone. You have this increase in estrogen and testosterone that lends really well to having the mental capacity to do that because your estrogen, your hormones and your neurochemicals and your whole biochemistry, like they all, you know, have this interplay, and we sometimes forget about that. And and women traditionally have been under-researched also. So like a lot of this isn't taught to us. It's something we know about our bodies, but we kind of tend to ignore because the norm of discussion doesn't really engulf like this area of information.
It's like there's an expectation that things should be flatlined, but we're really going on a little bit of a roller coaster. Or a 100%. Yeah, throughout the month.
And we can definitely see how much of a roller coaster we've been in just like the last 2 weeks.
Yes.
And that's in addition to our cycles.
So like we are coming at you guys live from in the thick of the COVID-19 crisis. This is March 26th today.
Yeah, I think so. I have no concept of time. Yeah.
We are working from our homes. We are social distancing. And we're actually going to talk about self-care because both of us have both of our own challenges, like our sort of group challenges, self-care challenges that we're presenting to our communities. And Anne has one dedicated to self-care, especially in this time. And can you tell us about it? Do you have a 7-day self-care challenge going on right now?
Yeah, I have a 7-day self-care challenge, which I partially made a little bit selfishly because I'm in need of that and I want people to do it with me. And I also had requests from patients in my community to do something like that. So they're all like quick and easy things to do. I feel like sometimes we overcomplicate self-care. Self-care really can take as little as 10 seconds and can take as long as, you know, weeks on end if you wanted it to. But my goal was to basically just get us to do things that help us feel like ourselves. So every day is a different challenge. There's a video that goes along with it. And I'm doing them as we go along. And actually, I love the first activity that's in there, which is creating a self-care reference guide. And I do this with when I do self-care talks and stuff like that. Well, that's one of the activities that I love doing because sometimes when you're like in a funk or just not feeling like yourself, you're like, oh, I don't know what's going to get me out of this. So if you have something to look at and be like, okay, you know what? I can drink it, make myself a cup of tea, or I can just like do 2 minutes of exercise or whatever the case may be and try to get out of this funk that I'm in. Mm. I feel like it's helpful to have something written down or easily accessible. So the exercises, you divide a piece of paper into 4 quadrants and then you do things that you can, that help you, that are your self-care activities on a daily basis, something that you can do, something you can do on a weekly basis, monthly basis, and a yearly basis. So daily for me, for example, looks like some kind of movement. It doesn't have to be, you know, some big 30-minute, 60-minute workout. It could be as simple as going for a walk or doing 10 squats or lunging around the house or dancing around the house. I practice gratitude before I sleep. I drink a cup of tea. That's definitely one of mine. Mm-hmm. Running is not my thing. So running is never on any of my self-care lists. And then weekly, it looks like I am part of a community band. So that's one of my weekly self-care activities, talking to a friend on the phone, doing a face mask. Mm-hmm. Monthly sort of things look like getting a skincare treatment from someone, or taking a bath once a month, actually meeting a friend in person. And then yearly can be travel or hosting an event or something like that. So I like the idea of having something. So the daily ones, you don't have to schedule in, but the other ones, I actually schedule them into my calendar because then I'll actually do them.
So it doesn't get away from you. So you're like, oh, this month I know this is my self-care commitment to myself that I'm going to do. I'm going to go get a massage, or I'm going to do a float tank, or
yeah,
whatever it is.
It's so yeah, cool. And for you, it could be like surfing. I know you like to surf.
Yeah, yeah. Trying to make that a weekly thing, but it's ending up being monthly. It's kind of like whenever I can, whenever there are waves.
Yeah, for and, sure. Yeah. Yours is also weather dependent. So.
Oh my gosh, yeah, is it ever? But yeah, so you were saying, so it's a four quadrant graph, and it's daily, weekly, monthly,
yearly. Yeah, actually, I have mine here. Let me show you.
Yeah, let's see.
So yes, it looks something like this.
Yeah.
I think that says daily, weekly, monthly, and yearly, or it could be quarterly or annually, something more long-term. And the reason why I care so much about self-care is because self-care helps us refill our cups. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way we can show up for ourselves, for our dreams and our goals, for the people in our life in our best capacity. Like, mm-hmm. I know I'm super irritable if I'm not taking good care of myself. I procrastinate more. I'm less productive. I snap at my mom and my husband a lot more. And I also make poor life choices in terms of like eating and not exercising. Like everything kind of gets derailed if I'm not taking good care of myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we always think like, I know I've been through a journey where I regarded self-care as being selfish, and I had to really work through that and understand that by filling your own cup, you're then able to help other people. And so it's the least selfish thing you can do is take care of yourself.
Yeah, completely. Sort of like expecting,
like it's like lending your friend your iPhone when the battery is totally dead. It's not helped anybody. It's like, here, I'm going to recharge it, and now you can borrow it for the whole day. So this is this idea. And that whole, the metaphor of the oxygen mask, like you're putting the oxygen mask on the plane on yourself first and then helping others. What are you seeing that people needed help with? So in light of this COVID-19 and your community reached out to you and were asking for this self-care challenge, what were they struggling with?
A lot of anxiety. Mm-hmm. Anxiety is a big one that's coming up, and you know, I can definitely relate to that because I've felt anxious a lot this whole last week, week and a bit. And there's so much uncertainty, right? And uncertainty brings on anxiety because we don't know what life looks like. We had a schedule, and now the rug's been pulled from under our feet, and we're like, how do I get my bearings again? So there's been a lot of anxiety, and actually a lot of news-related anxiety. So people are like, you know what, every time I watch the news, I just feel so anxious. So one of the strategies that I've been implementing myself and with and recommending to patients is actually, let's limit that time that you're ingesting news to like one time or two times a day and no more, so that you can get out of that state and do something else that, you know, brings you joy or brings you peace or, you know, connect with other people. Mm-hmm. So anxiety is a big one. What else am I seeing? And some despair. There's a lot of loss, right? Loss and powerlessness that people are feeling as well. From, again, the lack of loss of structure, loss of vacation, loss of routine, loss of income for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So there's, and those are totally normal. I'm sure, I know we've talked about it, that we've been feeling some of these things as well. And I know I have. There was a day where I definitely like just cried for a bit and let it all out, which I think is fine, right? Like we got to let those emotions out as well and then regroup when we get a chance and then do the things that help us through this time and maybe create new routines. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I actually, I heard this from a friend, and she gave this metaphor, which I actually really love. It's like we had been juggling all these balls before COVID-19, and then when it hit, we dropped all our balls, or the universe you caused all our balls to drop, and now we have the opportunity to pick the balls that we actually want to pick and move forward with, and not stick with the same routine that we were in the past. And I really loved that because I do feel like, especially in the last couple of days when I have been feeling a little bit better than last week, I've done a bit of a reframe as to how do I want my life to look like once this is done, and what are the things that I want to continue with, what are the things that I want to let go of, what are the things that I want to do more of. So like, just sometimes my husband and I are in the same house every day, but we don't really spend time together, like connecting, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, but I want more of that. So this is a nice time to, I don't know if it's a nice time to, but it is a time to, to reevaluate some of those things, because we have the time to do that.
Totally. Yeah. So it's like a time I was listening to something today and it was saying, this is a time when we're staying home, but not just in our physical homes, in our internal homes as well. And it was interesting because in talking to patients this week, so I, yes, saw tons of anxiety, lots of grief. I shared an article actually about how a lot of what we're feeling is this grief over the loss of our lives, like our normal lives.
Yeah.
But I also was noticing that even some of my patients with anxiety, it was mixed in with a little bit of this sense of like, oh, my really stressful job that was causing me all this anxiety, I now have a break from, and I'm staying home. And some people were commenting that their kids were saying things like, "Mom, can we do this for the rest of our lives? Like just hang out at home all day?" And I think it's a mixed bag, right? Like, cause you know, there is this time for reflection and there is this time to relieve ourselves of these stressful things. Like I no longer need to go and do all these errands cause I can't. So these obligations that were on us previously are now no longer on us. But then there's this uncertainty, like you said, about the future that, and this lack of control about how other people are behaving, this lack of knowledge about this infection, and then just how long this is going to go on or what this means for our goals and dreams, right? Things that we care about. So it's a complicated time, a lot of emotion.
It's definitely a complicated time. And same thing, I have also been receiving comments that it's a bit of a relief to not do all the things that we normally do and just spend time with partners or family members or alone, whatever the case may be. And people are doing stuff around their house that they thought they would never be doing or they wouldn't be doing for a while. And it's also really lovely how communities are coming together and there's so much compassion as well, right? Like there's lots of strife, but there's also lots of like positives coming from it. And I think the mind shift just keeps teetering and tottering for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like I've seen so much creativity flourish from people during this time. And then a lot of giving, like you said, a lot of connection, and I don't know. Yeah. There's something, even though it's all on social media and all on the internet, there's something where I was walking and walking my dog and I ran into two people I don't know. We're keeping our 6 feet apart from each other, but we're stopping to talk. And that would never have happened if we were just going about our regular lives. So it was a really neat thing. Yeah. Had this small town type feel, but in the middle of downtown Toronto. So that was cool.
Yeah.
And so with your self-care, what are the daily things you're doing during this time? So you started the self-care challenge partly to help yourself stay accountable. And I totally get that. Like, you're like, I need to be meditating every day. So let's do a challenge and let's get everyone to do it. But what are your, so you talked about some of your daily things, but what are the things you're finding are helping right now?
Right now, daily, I'm talking to someone. That's really helping me right now, for sure. And that's, some of that is just friends, some of that is just my mom, some of that is like colleagues, for example. I know we've talked before, and other groups of colleagues as well. So that's been really helpful. I've been reading more, which is also helpful. It gets me out of like, you know, up here into just like focusing on the words on the page. That's been super helpful. I'm still drinking my tea. I'm doing daily movement, typically outside. My workspace actually has this, it's not really a balcony. It's just, you can open the door and stand there with a grill. So I stand there a lot, and there's a lot of dogs on my street. So I just watch them. That's really been helpful too. And dog videos. I love dog videos, so I watch a lot of those, and usually my husband and I will watch them together. And the other thing that my husband and I are doing more of is playing games, like board games or video games. We typically play them, but in the last I would say 2-3 months that went out the window. So we've been spending a little bit more quality time that way.
Like doing this, like you said, quality time.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's not just sort of being in each other's presence while you're going about your busy lives. Like, let's play a board game. Let's do something that gets us off the internet, but helps us connect at the same time and passes the time a little bit.
For sure. Absolutely. How about you? What are you doing these days to get you through and to, you know, support your body and mental health?
Yeah. Like, so last week my community was saying, we're commenting about, you know, I'm overeating and I'm lying on the couch all day. And what do you have?
Oh, yes.
Recommendations. Yeah. And I responded, I had like an answer at the ready, right? I was talking about building in routines and why we might be kind of, you know, have the munchies around this time, because it's not full on fight or flight anxiety. It's more of this low level anxiety that typically gets us eating. Like, we're kind of bored. It's that like low level kind of thing. So I had all these answers and I was talking about routines. And then I sat with myself this weekend and realized that I don't really have great routines. I wasn't really doing it. So I started thinking more carefully about how I'm actually structuring my day and what my goals are for the day. There's been a huge change in my practice. And sometimes I have an entire day that's open, which can be very stressful if I just sit and think about all the things I can't control. So I'm waking up with an alarm, as I normally do, having my breakfast. I usually start my morning with food, always, which is part of my cortisol care challenge, is talking about protein in the morning, and my coffee, which is my devil's version of your tea. This is my self-care. I'll have my coffee and maybe read something, and then go walk my dog. So I'm walking my dog a few times a day, and that's really nice. It also helps me not feel guilty about getting outside, because I know even in countries where there is full-on lockdown, there are exceptions for pharmacies, grocery shopping, and dog walking. My friend and I were laughing about that because my friend's like, well, we need to walk too, but the dogs are really an exception. So I'll walk him a few times a day, just get outside. And I also have a movement practice. So I would normally go to the gym, but since gyms have been shut down, I've been finding it really hard to work out on my own, to follow a yoga class. Like I find it so easy to just grab my yoga mat and head to a structured yoga class for an hour or even 2 hours and stay motivated. Cause there's something about just surrendering to what's happening in the class and just following instructions. Whereas, and it takes a lot for me to, like, I wouldn't leave a class even if I was bored halfway through, but when I'm doing it on my own and I'm watching a video and I'm in my house and I'm not accountable to anyone, there's no sort of space that we're creating, it's hard for me. So I'm trying to commit to at least like 13 minutes, 30 minutes of yoga, and trying to do that daily because it's really important for my body to do yoga, I've been noticing. Following like normal eating routines and not being like, it's 10, let's have an early lunch at the sink. Like, let's sit down and eat properly.
Yeah.
Which I realized I wasn't doing, you know, I thought I was, but then I actually thought about it. I'm like, no, I had like 5 meals today, healthy meals, but 5 meals.
Yeah.
So just sort of structuring in a routine, like organizing what I'm going to have for lunch as if I was taking it to work, planning my day around a goal that I want to accomplish, getting outside a lot. And like you said, talking to people. And there's a program for mental health. So for people with, it's mainly for people with depression, that's been developed by psychiatrists, and it's evidence-based program, very simple lifestyle-based program. And one of their, and it's called the Wild Five Wellness. Mm-hmm. One of the five pillars is social interaction, and their challenge or the advice they give is just to call or see in person. But now our option is only to call 2 people in your life a day. So I'm thinking about if I'm doing that, and I'm actually pretty good at sticking to that, I think, which has been really important, because otherwise to just be completely alone or just being in a texting sort of interaction with people is not enough. I went surfing yesterday, but I just got a notice that the parks are closed. So I'm not sure if surfing is open, although I was there by myself, so I was definitely social distancing. There are people on shore looking at me like I was crazy, but that's kind of normal because it's still March in Canada. Yeah, that's my self-care routine. So yeah,
I love that. I love the scheduling, and yeah, that is something that like this, like all, I have a lot of scribbles in here, and these are actually like my to-do lists for the day. And so I have like work related stuff that I want to do, but I also put in like my exercise, cook, read, like I'll put other things. So for two reasons, I'm like, I'm going to look at it and be like, okay, I'm going to do these things. And number two, I can cross them off and get some dopamine being released for accomplishing things. Yeah. Because like, that's for me, I need that motivation personally. I know that about myself. There's like intense mm-hmm. satisfaction that comes from crossing things off my list. Mm-hmm. So I definitely am doing a little bit more of that. There's something else that you said that I really resonated with. I can't remember though. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to me, I'll let you know.
Dude, come on. Yeah, because I wanted to say something too, like when you were talking about your grid and then even now with dopamine. So I think it's so useful, right, to have these things written down, like your self-care cheat sheet, like you said, because one of the conversations I have with a lot of my patients is they're like, when I get home from work, my battery is completely depleted, and what I want and what I end up doing, so my goal for myself is to go to a yoga class or go to a pottery class or do something that I know is going to be nourishing, but what I end up doing is buying a bag of chips, sitting on the couch, and flipping through my Instagram. It's kind of mindless thing. And so we talk about two neurotransmitters that are kind of in charge of either of those situations. And one is dopamine and the other serotonin. And I think with dopamine, dopamine is like our dog chasing the ball neurotransmitter, where it motivates us to do something, to pursue something, to seek out a certain behavior. And so we get hits of dopamine even in planning activities. So if you think about going to buy a bag of chips, if the chips have given you a hit of dopamine in the past, it gives you a hit of dopamine to even plan to do that. And then something like Instagram, you don't really necessarily need to put effort into engaging with that medium, but you do get little mini hits of dopamine as you're playing around with it. But these things are not nourishing. And so going to your yoga class, going to your pottery class, maybe doesn't provide that same anticipatory motivation or excitement. But when you're in it, it creates serotonin hits. And so it feels really good while you're in it and afterwards. And so a lot of those things on your self-care list are these like serotonin boosters, but you're not necessarily going to crave your cup of tea. I mean, after time, maybe like, oh yeah, what I really need is a cup of tea, but you know, for me, I'll crave coffee because I'm like, it's going to get me it's gonna get me high.
And that actually, you hit the nail on the head. Like, that's something actually I was going to speak to that I forgot about. Mm-hmm. Is like, sometimes we actually have to force ourselves to do the things that will be good for us. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like sometimes you have to force yourself to go to the yoga class. Like, I don't know about you, but I know, like, I love my Sunday evening rehearsals with my band. But it's, mm-hmm. and I know like if I go, I will feel amazing. I will feel awesome afterwards because I love it. However, sometimes getting to there, even though it's 5 minutes away from me, that's the challenging bit. Mm-hmm. And that's when I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. but it's so comfortable here. I don't want to move. Yeah, and then now, exactly. So for accountability, like for me, like I do it with my husband for some things. But I definitely need that external motivation. So he reminds me, he's like, yeah, but you feel you love band. Like that's all he has to say. I'm like, it's true. I love band. I'm going to go. But I'm sure you do this too. Like when we're talking about creating shifts in habits, I always get patients to write down what's the motivation behind this. What are you going to feel afterwards? Why do you want to actually do this? Because we forget, right? Mm. Like, and it's a pretty normal process to forget. Mm-hmm. And we get busy and things go out the window, and having it written down, I love writing things down, as you can see from my scroll. I think it's a super helpful tool. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you get you get the dopamine hit when you check it off. So like there's your dopamine right there. It's a great point because it's sort of this, it also, dopamine is in charge of our decision making. And so if you need to make a lot of decisions, you know, it's sometimes just not going to happen. And so for me, the success with exercise was just having it in a schedule and just going. And it wasn't really a negotiation with myself. It was like the alarm went off and you go through the motions, you just end up in the class. Now it's tough because our routines are shifted. So we have to like really schedule things in again so that we don't have to make decisions. So it's not like, what am I doing now? Am I cooking? Am I grocery shopping? What am I cooking? Am I doing yoga? Am I doing my virtual gym kickboxing class? Am I going for a walk? It's like, no, it's yoga, it's 2:00, it's happening, and then you feel good after and it's done, you know.
Yeah, you almost had like muscle memory of the like your schedule, and now your muscles are like, what do I do? Yeah, like, so now you have to retrain. Yeah, you have to shift and retrain, and it's hard.
And it's tough because I think a lot of us are, at least last week, I was really feeling like, oh, this is all going to be temporary. Like, we'll be back. And my clinic was closed officially for 2 weeks. I was like, oh, I'll be back next week. It's not looking like that right now. And so it does seem like it's pertinent to be creating these routines again and sort of settling into, even when you go on vacation, I think we, you know, if you're sort of staying in a place for a while, like we'll still create routines when we're on vacation. Like our bodies really love routines because it takes the decision-making out of these things we need to do to nourish ourselves. Like we need to sleep, we need to eat, we need to move. And so if those things are all planned, then they're taken care of and we can spend our mental energy on being creative and following other goals, which is really good.
For sure. Yeah. Decision fatigue is,
yes.
Yeah. Not fun to deal with.
Exactly. Yeah. We call it decision fatigue, also like prefrontal cortex fatigue. It's like our dopamine fatigue. And this is the whole idea of, I had one patient talk about how she would have such bad decision fatigue that she would sort of be halfway through a task and then just stop. And so we really talked about how, we really need to just build in systems that run themselves. Sort of, it's like you have this team of employees doing your work for you. It's really you doing it, but you're not putting in the mental energy to get all of that stuff done. Like you're kind of mindlessly making your sweet potato because it was planned in your schedule and you knew that you were going to do it. And it was planned that you were going to buy the sweet potato and have it. And then you can use your brain for what you want to use it for, which is maybe daydreaming or listening to podcasts or creating things and all that stuff. And not having to make decisions around all these things. So it's a good point. So the self-care list. Mm-hmm. Do you have any other take homes or things that you've learned in this journey of putting together your new routines during this time, or things that your community has pointed out, or any other tips from your self-care challenge that you want to share?
The biggest one I'll say is really just forgiving myself. We're all in it together. We're all creating these new routines, and routines don't, you know, get made in a week. It takes more time than that. When we're talking about habits and changing behaviors, you know, 21 days and then 62 to 65 days, like that's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And the routines that we had for so many years, pretty much, those have now shifted. Mm-hmm. So really being forgiving of myself is a big one that I will say is really important at this point in time, because I'm used to like getting things done, right? Like I'm used to getting things done in a certain fashion and a certain manner. And it can be really destructive if I ride down that spiral of feeling that way. Mm-hmm. And then the second one, like you said, and like we've just talked about, is actually building a routine and writing things out. Like I think that's been super helpful for me. And I've heard that from so many people this week as well, that we've actually made to-do lists. We've made things that we want to do, and vision boarding. Everyone's this week, that's the second thing that I heard was vision boarding, which goes back to like picking up the balls that you want to pick and then moving toward that. And taking it day by day. The situation is changing on a very rapid basis, but it does look like we're going to be here for some time. So, those are my two cents.
Those are great things. Yeah, it's like you're kind of, I always think of surfing metaphors, but you're basically trying to stay balanced on your board these are not clean waves we are dealing with. These are very choppy, messy waves that we can't see or read properly. But these things like vision boards and to-do lists, or I've also heard of have done lists, which I like too.
You're like
grocery shop. Oh, I've done that. I just want to like write something so I can check it up. But you know, these things, that they help us stay oriented to like, what kind of day did I have today? I don't know, because it's totally different from what I would have had 2 weeks ago. So I feel like I'm useless. I feel like everything's falling apart. And then you sit and look at your to-do list or your vision board and you're like, no, I'm on track. The big things, the big balls are up in the air. That didn't sound right, but you know what I mean. The important balls.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's true though. Like some days I'm like, what did I even do today? Mm-hmm. Which is totally fine. Like if you do nothing on a day, it is totally fine.
Right. Yeah.
But I do want to get some things done in this time. So having a list of some kind and going through my day, even reflecting at the end of the day has been helpful. I'm like, okay, today I cleaned the kitchen. I baked some zucchini loaf, which are things that I did. And I had intended to clean my closet, which I will proceed to do at least a little bit of. And even if it's like an incomplete task, that's still, you know, you made progress, and that's really what we should be. We should be celebrating anything that we're doing or not. Even like giving into your emotions in a day, I feel like that's worth celebrating, because like this is a weird time.
Mm-hmm, totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Rudolf Steiner talks about that, the founder of Waldorf, among other things. He talks about at the end of the day, I forget what he calls it, but you go through the events of the day in reverse. It's like, I just put myself to bed, I just brush my teeth, and you sort of like digest it all. It's cool. It's, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And it's beautiful because it sort of just orients us to like, rather than just heading through the day, you know, face forward, like leaning in, we're sort of, okay, what was that like? And savoring the experience of being alive.
Yeah.
Right. And so where can we find you? How can we get in on this challenge?
So my challenge is up on, you can always find me on Instagram. I'm pretty active on there. Not as much these, I would say like it's hit or miss these days. Some days where I'm feeling it, I'm on there a lot. And then other days where I'm like, I'm just going to take a step back. But Instagram, my handle is dr.annehussain. So my full name. And then the challenge is available through there in my bio, or you can go to annehussain.com/self-care and you can access my challenge through that as well.
All right. We'll have links at the bottom of this video on YouTube and in the description. And then in Facebook, we'll put it in the comments. All right, Anne, thank you so much for joining me. You're also you're part of the Good Mood Project group. So
I love people the Good
can
Mood Project.
Directly message you if they want to. They can tag you and comment and ask questions.
Yeah.
So take care and have
you
a good
too.
Day.
Thanks. Bye. Hi, everyone. Today I have with me Dr. Talia Marchegiani, a naturopathic doctor with a focus on mental health and hormones. Hi, Talia. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with you telling us a little bit about yourself, the work that you do, and how you came to do the work that you do. So basically, tell us everything.
All right. So, well, yeah, we'll keep the story short, but basically, I've always been interested in psychology and in mental health, and as a window to our general health and well-being. So it's sort of like, what's one of life's greatest values? You can't participate in life if you don't feel physically well, and then it's very difficult to feel physically well if we don't feel mentally well. So it was really interesting to me to focus on mental and emotional wellness as one of the key pillars of health. And I also felt that our skills as a naturopathic doctor fit really well into understanding our mental and emotional wellness. Because, you know, we have conventional solutions, but they leave a lot of gaps in treatment. And so not everybody responds well to the common treatments of medication and therapy. And there's a lot left uncovered in terms of, you know, how our hormones are working, inflammation, gut microbiome, oxidative stress and brain function and nutrition. So there's so many things that could really impact our health in a positive way that so many people don't know about. And it leaves, so I felt like naturopathic medicine was a key pillar in a comprehensive care plan for somebody who not even is suffering from a mental health diagnosis or mental health condition, but someone who just wants to optimize their mood and their hormonal health, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I became a naturopath. All right. What's the short story of this? Well, I studied pre-med at Queen's, and my goal was to be a medical doctor. And just through that journey with my own health, just contemplating sort of what was important to me and the kind of medicine I wanted to practice, I was interested in sort of grassroots type medicine. So doing the detective work and really getting to know a patient, putting dots together, and really understanding what lay below the surface versus putting someone into a diagnostic category. And I had my own experience with the medical system and feeling like I was left out because I didn't have a diagnosis, and all of my lab work came back, you know, all of my blood work came back in the normal ranges, but I still didn't feel well. And I feel like so many of my patients are in those in between places where they're not getting the medical attention they need. They're not accessing the solutions that they might need.
and they're sort of told that they're fine, or maybe they're getting a mental health diagnosis without a real solution that's impacting how they feel, and so much is left out. And so it, you know, I felt like I wanted to practice a kind of medicine where we would take a deep dive into what was going on, really get to know each other, spend a lot of time in the visit, and be able to access all of the factors that influence our health. So, you know, getting deep into diet, getting deep into mindset, getting deep into our lifestyle practices or routines, how we live, psychological health, and use all the different tools that we have at our disposal, and be able to use things that are up and coming in the current evidence, and be able to play in that space rather than wait the 20 years for something to become established in the medical literature. You know, I feel like we can implement things like nutrition and certain nutritional supplements and herbal medicine before it becomes sort of common practice in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you touched a little bit on the medications, and we know, like in Canada, for example, between the ages of 18 and 45, the two most prescribed medications are antidepressants and oral contraceptive pills. And these are, and I know you're not anti-medication, and I'm definitely not anti-medication either, but they're oftentimes used as first-line therapies when, as you mentioned, there's so many different factors that come into play when we're looking at mental health. So can you speak a little bit to the different factors that impact our mental health in a little bit more detail? Like what role does the gut microbiome play? What role does our food choices and our lifestyle play?
Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, what we've done is narrowed down the diagnostic category of something like depression or anxiety. And so the narrative, which is actually more of a metaphor, goes along the lines of there's a chemical imbalance in your brain, so specifically a deficiency in serotonin. But then, you know, there are other neurotransmitters that medications act upon, like norepinephrine and dopamine, but more commonly it's serotonin, which is a chemical in our brain that produces feelings of pleasure, contentment, satisfaction, is associated with positive mood states. But it's only one part of the picture, And so this narrative goes that you have a deficiency in serotonin. This is probably something you were born with. And often people who have depression, anxiety have a family history. So you're sort of born with this imbalance, and then the medication steps in to correct that imbalance. So it's sort of like, oh, this is like insulin for diabetes or eyeglasses for someone who's nearsighted. And so that's often what patients are told. And if you talk to a prescribing physician and ask them if that's actually what's going on, they will probably tell you it's more of a metaphor, that it's not, like, we know in the research now that that's not the case. There's never been confirmation or evidence that that's actually what's going on. That doesn't mean that medication can't help people. So in some people, it's about 30% of people that try medication respond to it. But the effects are pretty minimal. So, you know, overall, if we look at the general population, so there are some people that will tell you that either they or a family member or a close friend was feeling extremely depressed or anxious, tried a medication, and it really made a difference for them. But those people are washed out by an equal number of people who experienced just as much harm from medication in terms of side effects, or others that just didn't notice a response at all. So, you know, we just want to support everybody and make sure that there are comprehensive solutions. So where depression comes from, I mean, so we do have serotonin, which is sort of our happy hormone. We have dopamine, which is associated with motivation and positive mood states as you're trying to chase a goal. It's associated with sort of this mental sharpness, you know, verbal acuity, sort of like creativity, and just that drive that we'll experience. And norepinephrine, which is a stress chemical, but has a component of euphoria and high energy. And so that can sort of boost our mood. So, you know, in depression, one of the key symptoms is that we feel lethargic and low energy. So these three neurochemicals are really important for mood, but there are so many other things going on. And in the brain of someone who's depressed, one thing that they consistently find is high levels of cortisol, which is a stress hormone. So there's high levels of the stress hormone, but the brain isn't responding to it properly. So this person is experiencing high stress hormone, but low effects of this stress hormone. So they're feeling fatigued, brain fog, low motivation, low drive, especially morning grogginess, disrupted sleep, changes in appetite, changes in weight, all of those classic symptoms. And so we have to understand, like, where would all that be coming from? Because we know that we're not just a brain and a body separated. We have our gut microbiome. We have antioxidants that our cells need to produce to clear out something called oxidative stress, which is sort of like these chemicals that can start to create inflammation in our brains. There are all these processes that go on in our body that are all connected to our mood states. And essentially, like, inflammation is one of the key players in someone with depression. So a little bit of inflammation that exists in the brain and body. And inflammation is, so if you cut yourself and you're, you know, and the area around your cut becomes red, swollen, painful, and hot, those are the four signs of inflammation. And that's, you know, an acute process that happens so that your body can heal. Your immune system creates inflammation to heal that wound. You know, you bang your elbow, same thing. You have arthritis, similar thing. But what happens is when we have low levels of inflammation, particularly in the brain, where we don't have pain receptors, what we normally experience is more of a brain fog, low mood, potentially anxiety, difficulty concentrating. So all of these sort of more cognitive symptoms rather than like pain in our brain, like you might feel if you cut yourself or hit your arm or an area of the body that has pain receptors. So we know that inflammation is important for looking at one of the underlying causes of any sort of mental health condition, but depression is one of the more common ones. And so our goal as naturopathic doctors is, I mean, one thing we can do is prescribe anti-inflammatories. So like Advil is one, but more natural versions would be like curcumin, turmeric, or fish oils. Some of these common therapies that you might find or read about for depression, like natural therapies. But our goal is to find the source of the inflammation, right? So we're looking at what is driving this fire in the body that's causing these low mood states. And the gut microbiome, because that's where most of our immune system lies in our gut, is one of the key areas where we might uncover the source of inflammation. So, you know, and there's so many different things we can talk about in that area, but, you know, there are things like leaky gut where the barrier between the gut and the rest of the body is permeable. So you think of like an open border between countries, sort of like letting a lot of things in and out that maybe shouldn't be there. Let's say like your body really wants to keep things controlled in terms of what it lets in and what it keeps out of the body. And, you know, and if something is inside our digestive tract, it's still technically outside of our body. It's not because the digestive tract is open to the rest of the world, sort of like a long tube that goes from mouth to anus. And so anything that you consume is not yet quite part of you until you digest it. But with leaky gut, you start to absorb different things that may not be good for you. And then when we have an imbalance in our gut bacteria, that can also drive inflammation. And we also know that gut bacteria can produce some of those neurotransmitters we talked about, like serotonin, dopamine, and even cortisol. So, you know, our body is this whole ecosystem of different things going on, and we're trying to understand it. And if you drop chemicals in a river, that may affect things downstream from that river. It might affect the kind of trees that can grow, the kind of animals that live. So just, you know, altering one part of an ecosystem can have these widespread effects because everything is connected. And same goes for our body. So an imbalance in the bacteria in your gut or consuming daily a food that your body doesn't like possibly could have these effects that drive inflammation and then lead to low mood and depression or something like anxiety or even bipolar disorder. And so our goal is to go upstream and figure out what caused it all. Yeah,
for sure. And inflammation drives so many different processes, right? Like, and I can speak from personal experience. When I was in the throes of my PCOS, I was super constipated, for example. And once I started changing my diet a little bit, and that is a huge source of like how we might be contributing to our own inflammation on a regular basis is by the food choices that we make. Like, and that shifted my gut, and that automatically started shifting my hormones as well. And then the mood changes that I was having because I had low mood, and then that was exacerbated when I went on the birth control pill, and then it was still there when I came off the birth control pill. So There's all these like connections that we sometimes miss because we're like, okay, anxiety, depression has to do with the brain. Let's treat that only and not look at all the other things that might be happening. So, can we talk a little bit about the birth control pill and how it can impact mood? Because some women, you know, as you mentioned, even with medications for anxiety or depression, they tolerate it really well and they see an impact from it. Same thing with birth control pills. Some women feel kind of the same. Some women feel maybe a little bit better because their hormones are in a different state. However, there's a huge population that does not do well on them. What impact is the birth control pill having on our neurochemistry and our biochemistry?
Yeah. So again, it's kind of this idea of altering one aspect of our health. And this is a lot of what, again, not anti-medication, but when we prescribe medication, we have to understand the far-reaching effects, because one of the things that medications do are target one specific thing, but our body doesn't work that way. And when we think of adding hormones to our system, so the hormones in the birth control pill are synthetic estrogen and synthetic progesterone. Progestin, it's called, and some combination of those two. So sometimes you can just have a progestin only pill. It's not very common though, or you can do something like a Mirena IUD, which is just local progestin in a physical IUD that's supposed to be just working locally. So every single cell in the body interacts with those two hormones in some way. So when we think of, okay, birth control pill is just going to work on our reproductive system, that's not exactly right, because we do have receptors in our brain, bones, breast tissue, like every tissue is influenced by the fluctuations of estrogen and progesterone. And we know this, right? Because before your period, you may feel a different mood state. If you're sort of tracking your period and paying attention, as you always talk about, there are these different moods and emotions, and even just the way that our cognition works is different as our hormones fluctuate throughout our cycles. So when you're adding in a synthetic version of those hormones, and you're kind of, first of all, flatlining your hormones, which for women that are going through huge ups and downs might actually be a bonus, beneficial, but you're not actually adding in the exact hormone. So they're a little bit different. It's kind of like when you try and open the, like, a lock with a different key, it might slightly fit, but it may not turn that lock exactly the way the key that was made for that lock will. And so same thing with these hormonal systems. Hormones act like locks inside a key, which are receptors on our cells. And they talk to those cells and tell them what's going on and what should happen in the body. And so if you don't have a perfect fit, you're not going to get the exact effects of what a natural version of that hormone might do. And sometimes in some women that might not matter, but in others it might, because, you know, our estrogen progesterone fluctuations are impacting our brain and our mood, inflammation levels, gut microbiome, like essentially the entire system. And so a woman who, you know, maybe doesn't make enough progesterone, which could cause something like anxiety or, you know, or more inflammation in the body or issues with the kind of bacteria in their body or things like elimination, they may be a little bit more constipated. They might notice more weight gain, more water retention, things like that. Adding in a progestin, a synthetic version of progesterone, may not have the effects that reverse all those symptoms in every single part of their body. It might not alleviate anxiety. And if a woman has normal fluctuating hormones, but is just using the pill for contraception, it might alter her hormones in a way that's not beneficial for her. And we have a large Danish study that was done in, I believe it was 2015, but I can double check that. And it did show a correlation between teenage girls being prescribed oral contraceptives and their risk of depression. And so we know that altering our hormones is going to have an effect on our mood in some way. And so it's really about just, you know, working closely with somebody who's considering that potential side effect and being able to adjust, because there's so many different kinds of contraception, right? And everyone, you know, and we all have preferences and needs according to how our ability to take a pill every day, what our contraceptive needs are, what we feel comfortable with, you know, what our sexual health, you know, goals are, our fertility goals, and, you know, are the other factors, like if we're dealing with something like endometriosis or fibroids or PCOS, like you said,
we all have different needs. And so being able to work closely with your prescribing doctor or a complementary physician, like a naturopath, who may not necessarily be prescribing that medication, but can kind of coach you on, you know, how that pill might be affecting your mood and hormonal state is really important. I've had some patients come in and, you know, be on one pill, be experiencing various side effects, and our treatment was just to send them back to their family doctor requesting a different pill that just has a slightly different focus and a slightly different effect on hormones. That was just a better fit for them. And then those side effects went away. And so a lot of it is just giving things a different try and just being aware of that connection, right? And then there's also, there's some evidence. I mean, there's also some nutrients that might be depleted with the pill that we have to consider. So vitamin B6 is a big one. It's important for making serotonin. And if we're deficient in B6, we might not be making enough of serotonin. So it's also important to just consider, you know, how are we supporting that river that we're slightly altering, right? And can we understand how our whole system might be affected by this thing that we're adding, and can we adjust and make sure that we're supporting that system and minimizing side effects in that way?
For sure. And oftentimes it is those simple strategies, right? Like adding in some B vitamins, like B6 especially, in those women, and their mood completely changes, their energy completely changes because their body's working at a different level now, even though they're on the same medication. And I wanted to go back to a point that I've forgotten, but I'll come back to it. Yes, I remember now. So it has to do with like the different types of birth control. There's, especially now, there's so many varieties of different combinations that we can get and dosages that we can get. We know that for PMDD, there's specific ones that you can use. And if you use them cyclically, so just in the second half of the cycle, when those symptoms come up, like that's as effective or more effective than using it throughout the whole cycle, because then the body gets the chance to kind of take a break from it for 2 weeks. So definitely having these, I feel like it's just having these conversations with prescribing doctors, and maybe having another practitioner, such as a naturopathic doctor, functional medicine doctor, who can pick on the other things that are either being missed or not discussed, right? Because we're very accustomed to this healthcare model where doctor prescribes, we do. And we don't really question a lot of it, which was definitely my experience many years ago. I was put on birth control pill without really much of a discussion. And I also wasn't a good candidate because I have a family history of cardiovascular disease. And personally, I started getting like migraines right off the bat on the birth control pill. So definitely having a lot of these conversations, maybe switching medications or looking at options if it's not for a contraceptive purpose, because oftentimes these medications are also being used as first line options when, you know, someone might not be drinking enough water, or they're not, you know, eating a variety of foods that will shift their gut microbiome to be healthier, or, you know, eating a lot of inflammatory foods like high in sugar and refined sugar and refined foods, and drinking a lot of coffee and drinking a lot of alcohol, which will ultimately have an impact on everything.
Totally.
Yeah,
so, that's a good point, right? It's like I always talk about this, like it's not that it's inappropriate to go on the pill. It just, is this a first line treatment for something that maybe we can use another therapy for? And it's all about just being informed, like what are your goals? And I've been on the birth control pill before for contraception because it was the best choice for me at the time. But if I had, you know, irregular cycles or heavy cycles, I may choose a different course of treatment first before reaching for that option. And I think patients just need to know what the available options are and exactly how the pills are working. Because one thing that they'll say to me is, I'll ask about periods and menstrual cycles, and patients will tell me, well, yeah, my cycle's really regular, it's light, I'm on the pill. And one of the things that we have to talk about is that your cycle or your period on a pill is not actually a real period. It's a withdrawal bleed. And, you know, and that's, so we just don't understand the effects necessarily of what the pill is having on our bodies. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily good or bad. It's just about being informed and really understanding what the impact might be. And so that we can make an empowered, informed choice about it.
Exactly. And then ultimately it comes back to the patient, whatever it is that they want to do, and supporting them in that choice. But oftentimes it's just not presented as a choice, which is unfortunate. So we talked a little bit about the hormonal changes and impact on mood that happen. Can we go through a menstrual cycle and what some of those mood changes, hormonal changes look like?
Sure. Yeah.
You know, so, I like talking about cycles a lot.
So cool. Yeah. It's so interesting because one of the things with hormones is, so we like to think linearly, right? We like to think this does this in the body. It's just a simple way to conceptualize things. But hormones are so sticky and difficult because they're webs and networks. And when you start to dig into what they actually do, they don't necessarily have this linear effect. So if you take something like estrogen, estrogen has certain symptoms if you have levels that are too high. But also if your levels are too low, there are symptoms. But and sometimes the excess estrogen symptoms and estrogen deficiency symptoms can look similar. And then there's also the relative levels of hormones, right? So you might look like you have high levels of estrogen where your estrogen levels are completely normal and it's that progesterone, which opposes estrogen or works with estrogen to balance it out, may just be too low. So like take testosterone, for example, or male hormones, androgens in a woman's body. You know, if a woman has high androgen like symptoms, it's like acne, hair loss in places you don't want, which is what you say, and hair growth in places you don't want, you know, maybe changes in body composition. There's a whole bunch of different effects. But if I test a woman's body, a woman's blood, I might find that their testosterone levels are low or normal. And it's about the other hormones not being able to balance out the testosterone levels. Or other androgens like DHEAS or DHT. So it's all about looking at this big picture and trying to understand how everything works together, how it affects our other systems in the body, like cortisol, insulin, blood sugar, gut health. There's a whole bunch of things going on. And estrogen also affects our levels of dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin. So there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. But generally, what happens is the first day of your cycle is the first day that you bleed, the first day of your period. And that's where your hormone levels are essentially like at their lowest. It's the drop of those two hormones that causes the shedding of the uterine lining, so the menstrual cycle. And then what starts to happen is estrogen starts to climb and it reaches a little bit of a peak around ovulation. Dips a little bit after ovulation, and then it peaks again mid-luteal phase, which is about a week. If you have a 28-day cycle, about 7 days before your period, so in the last you know, three quarters of your cycle, you'll get another bump up of estrogen, and then it drops. And after ovulation, progesterone rises, peaks around the same time the estrogen peaks in the mid-luteal phase, that same, you know, day 21, 1 week before your period of a 28-day cycle, and then drops. So estrogen's got a little bit like an M pattern. So it rises, it dips a bit, rises again, and drops. And progesterone is just like an upside down U. So rises and falls. There are other hormones at play, but those are two big ones in terms of promoting ovulation, building a uterine lining. And so, you know, what we typically notice is when estrogen builds, depending on other factors, typically we notice, so estrogen slows down dopamine clearance, and dopamine's all about motivation, focus, positive mood states, drive, particularly sex drive. So when estrogen rises on its own, sometimes, so like that kind of during ovulation, some women will feel really motivated, really focused, able to perform well, more creative. But when estrogen's a little bit too high, we might also feel more anxious. So it depends on how your body, like you know, your maybe genetic predispositions, the presence of other hormones in the body, how you might respond. But typically, the first half of the cycle, women feel more positive mood states, more motivation, more energy. And the second half of the cycle, particularly that week before your period, a little bit more of a volatile mood. And this could look like more irritability, more anxiety, more sort of low mood states. And this has to do more with, you know, the balance between estrogen and progesterone during that second half of the cycle. So estrogen typically, or progesterone typically has like a calming effect on the body, but when those two hormones are out of balance, that can cause more anxiety. And also how we are able to clear estrogen, because when estrogen goes too high, it can also be associated with anxiety. It slows the clearance of epinephrine and norepinephrine, our anxiety hormones. And some people will experience inflammation in response to some of those chemicals, which can then cause low mood. So, typically women will feel the best once their period finishes and the worst right before their period starts.
Yeah.
But we have like tons of variety, right? Because somebody might be suffering from painful periods. And so that week's not going to be fun. Premenstrual migraines, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, or PMS. So something, hormonal states associated with other things like histamine and a sensitivity to progesterone, particularly, that are causing rapid and very dramatic changes in mood when those hormones shift. And so it's really like understanding a woman's experience. And I love tracking cycles and just really paying attention to how you feel, because everyone feels a little bit different. And I know you talk a lot about just working, like being aware of your cycles and then trying to arrange as best you can your schedule or your goals for the month around your best times, and then scheduling in more rest during the times that you most need it. Eating more chocolate maybe when you need it.
I'm actually out of chocolate right now. I used to do a grocery shop there. And so we're recording this during COVID-19 physical distancing. So, the 2 week shopping trips have rendered me without chocolate for the last few days. thankfully, it's my follicular face. I'm tolerating it pretty good.
Yeah, you're like, in a week or so, you're like, I gotta run.
I gotta have some chocolate. But it's so true, like what you were talking about, this interplay between hormones, because even when we look at research on estrogen and progesterone alone, the impacts on different cells is so complicated. Even if we look at like fibroids, for example, and they're like the role of estrogen and progesterone, it's not just estrogen and progesterone, it's all the other factors as well, the interplay. There's receptors that are turned on and off by like the same thing. There's so much interplay, and we can't really just be like, okay, this is cause, this is effect. And that's why I love our medicine, because we look at the whole body and figure out what can be contributing factors. Even if there's not a clear cut answer, we can piece it together really nicely and support our patients in that way. And the hormonal system, for sure, it's like a web, and then it has offshoots from that web. And then the neurotransmitters, for example, have their own web. And then there's like feeding into the gut. Like each of our systems have their own webs. And these are like complicated layers of intertwined fun. So totally. So like the body's super fascinating, and that's why I chose medicine in the first place, because I loved how everything was so fascinating, even at the cellular level, how the mitochondria work and how your organs work and all those sorts of things. So it's if you're a listener, just make sure you understand that it's not just like one thing and then one result. It's everything is connected and everything is interconnected. So when we're talking about treatment plans, that's why we're talking about, diet and lifestyle and mindset and supplements and acupuncture and testing. And testing isn't everything. Like you said, we have to actually listen to what you're experiencing and then connect everything to that, because brain inflammation for someone can look like one thing, but for another person can look like another thing. Mm-hmm. Low progesterone can look like one thing for someone and then look like premenstrual spotting for someone, but it can look like, really high anxiety for someone else, or a combination for another person. So we also always have to keep this perspective and this bird's eye view when we're talking about health in general. So we talked a little bit about, or a lot about, hormones and neurotransmitters and mood and medications. We talked about all of these things. So what are some of your top tips or just top suggestions for people who might be having some mood issues? What's a good place to start? Which is, loaded question.
Right. Yeah. So I also want to jump off of what you were just saying, right? So we really want to, we're so tempted to think linearly, but you'll see if you research, like you just said, if you look up what does estrogen do? You're going to see that it causes thickening of the uterine lining, causes the proliferation of breast tissue and secondary sex characteristics in a woman. And then you read about something like estrogen dominance, which is sort of in natural health spaces, and estrogen sounds like this evil thing. And then you look at conventional medical research, and the drop of estrogen is what's causing all the symptoms of menopause, like vaginal dryness and brain fog and, you know, decline in cognitive function, motivation. So it's really about looking at that whole system, because you can't just say estrogen does this and, you know, and it doesn't act like a drug. Whereas a drug has one effect or one goal. And of course they, you know, drugs don't cause side effects. They're just part of the effects of the drug. They're just unwanted. But we're trying to chase a specific goal. And it's tough to do that because our body doesn't, it's hard for us to even think about how hormones work, because we are such linear thinkers. So when we're thinking of, okay, what would we do for somebody with a specific symptom? We're trying to think as non-linearly as possible. We're trying to paint the entire web out as best we can and bring in as many puzzle pieces and factors as we can to start to connect the dots and get this picture. And part of that is the health history that's extremely important, is going through in detail all of these different factors. And a lot of the time there's strange questions that someone might be asked. Like, I might dig into someone's response to a medication, which is going to give us clues to, you know, what is going on at the level of their biochemistry and hormonal chemistry. You know, what kind of pill was a good fit for you? What kind of pill produced side effects that you can tolerate? Just really understanding what's happening, looking at things like, yeah, are you bleeding halfway through your cycle? How does that match with your blood work when we're looking at hormonal levels? So we're like trying to really understand as much as we can, mapping out someone's cycle, really diving in to symptoms, and paying attention in a way that you may not have been asked to pay attention before, right? Like a lot of the time people are perplexed, like, okay, you know, I didn't notice that this was connected to my cycle. Let me come back after I track for a bit and let you know. So a lot of it is tracking. A lot of it is gathering a history, doing some really focused blood work can help, potentially physical exams, is really collecting all the data. And then painting a picture of it and synthesizing it to try and understand what could be going on. And then what we're trying to do is, so we work under the assumption as naturopaths that our body is intelligent and is invested in creating health for us. And so we're looking at, you know, what obstacle might be in the way of our body being in its healthiest state. And can we remove that obstacle? Can we strengthen the system responsible for promoting health? So if we're looking at, you know, oh, maybe, you know, your estrogen is too high at certain times in your cycle, and that's one of the areas that are causing these symptoms. We're looking at, okay, why might that be happening? Is your liver not clearing those hormones efficiently? Is your gut microbiome turning the estrogen back on and allowing it to be reabsorbed? You know, is there a deficiency in certain nutrients in the diet that are helping with estrogen breakdowns? So we're trying to pull all of that together and essentially just set the stage for proper hormonal balance. So where I would start, I have kind of a pyramid. I like to communicate with patients sort of what's going on, because if you deliver a treatment plan, it kind of looks like we're making diet recommendations, we're prescribing herbs, we're prescribing vitamins. But it's nice to know what is our therapeutic strategy. What's our therapeutic pyramid? And I always start with baseline health foundation. So, you know, if you have a wilting plant, chances are you're going to think about it in terms of what does this plant need that it's not currently getting, and trying to set general lifestyle principles that are just feeding our body and promoting health that our body needs. Like, you know, we need food and nutrition, we need movement, we need social connection, we need time for rest and relaxation. There are just certain things we need. And we don't need to be perfect at any of these things. We don't need to be on the best diet ever or, you know, running marathons. It's more about how are we balancing our life to provide our body the soil and the conditions for health that are appropriate. And, you know, sometimes though, that just making those adjustments, right, just adding in more salad or just saying go outside in nature for a walk is not enough, because we've been in a state of deficiency or excess for too long. So a good example is somebody who is anemic because maybe they weren't getting enough iron, let's say, as a cause of that anemia. It may not be enough to just add in more iron-rich foods. We might actually have to supplement iron for a while to bring them back up into balance. You know, if someone's been magnesium deficient for a while, prescribing something like magnesium to bring them back into balance. Or if someone's been experiencing extreme stress, removing those sources of stressors as best we can. You know, it may not be enough to just kind of, okay, take a half hour rest every now and then. Like, we have to remove some of those obstacles to cure. And then, so that would be the second stage after we establish health foundations, is to look at, okay, what are some of the excesses that we can remove? And we can't remove all of them. Like, we can't necessarily just tell you to quit your job. What are some of the excesses that we can remove? And what are some of the deficiencies that we can restore? And, you know, and of course, we're looking at the cause of those deficiencies, but oftentimes it just, you know, maybe we just need higher levels of nutrition because of our own individual needs. And then the third stage I work at is reestablishing the balance between our hormonal systems. And so one of the things that happens with hormones, particularly, or other chemicals in the body, if we have been in a state of deficiency, or if there have been certain excesses going on for a while, is that our body can no longer bring itself back into balance or homeostasis. So we end up in these vicious cycles. And so we can take estrogen excess as an example, where if you're not eliminating estrogen properly, some of the estrogen actually can impair that same process of elimination. So you get stuck in a vicious cycle where the estrogen, the issue is causing more of the same issue. And so then we have to, I believe, as naturopathic doctors, intervene in that cycle and try and reverse it or stop it. So in that case would be like working on the gut microbiome to get things moving, putting, you know, adding in some phytoestrogens into the diet to help with rebalancing estrogen, working on liver clearance, adding in nutrients. And at that stage, I like to work with herbs a lot, because herbs work very much like hormones, where they rebalance things in a very intelligent way that acts like a network. Because herbs are like they have certain chemicals that work like hormones, and they tend to have a very balancing effect on the body when it comes to hormonal systems. So I often use herbs at that stage. Take magnesium, and here's Vitex, you know, so it could be like that. But it's all about the strategy and stacking and figuring out, you know, what are the best recommendations for that person and communicating that to them.
Yeah. And you framed that so nicely, like, you know, getting rid of the obstacles, or as much as possible, getting rid of the obstacles, and then addressing the nutrient deficiencies or excesses, and then maybe pressing restart or reset on some of the organ systems that need that support. Because you're right, like, there's so many cycles that we can enter. And same thing goes with like gut microbiome and anxiety, right? Like, if you're anxious, it'll change your gut microbiome, and then the gut microbiome being different will feed into the anxiety. So we have to, at some point, for depending on the person, press reset on that and kind of reestablish, like, okay, ground zero, and let's go from there. And that's the same thing for like most, especially like chronic conditions or conditions that have been going on for a long time, or anything that you might have recurrent episodes of. It's a similar strategy, right? Like, we have to look at everything and then work on it depending on who that person is, what their genetics are, what their symptoms are like.
No, your sound went off. I think you muted.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, now I can hear you.
Okay. Yeah. So, and it goes back to like what you were saying, and what I left saying is track your symptoms, track how you're feeling. And that could be, you know, in relation to cycling, to your cycle, if you are a cycling woman, and that could be not related to your cycle, if you're like postmenopausal, or you don't have a cycle anymore, or if you're, you know, postpartum. Track your cycles, because then you get a better idea of what's happening in your body, and then you can also relay it to your healthcare providers and advocate better for strategies that work for you. That's really why I love tracking, right? Like, it just is more information, and more we can make a better and
Oh, you're mute again. No. What's happening? Yeah, now you're back.
Okay. Technical difficulties.
Hmm. But yeah, but so yeah, so exactly. Yeah, it's like, yeah, I mean, the tracking is so important because so much information is pulled out of that, right? Like, because we're able to then map your cycle, because symptoms, I mean, most doctors will tell you 80% of the information comes from symptoms or more even. And so someone can tell you, yeah, 3 days before my cycle is when I get a raging migraine, then I start feeling bloated, I get breast tenderness, then I have a very heavy period, then the period stops and it starts again, then I feel amazed, then my mood is amazing afterwards, then I start to get anxious again. Oh, okay, so we're really understanding. I also have constipation, I also get headaches, and I have depression. So like we can map all that together and figure out what could be going on and come up with a strategy, as opposed to Googling PMS vitamins and finding a list of like 40 things that you could be taking and not knowing how to triage the importance of any of those things.
For sure. And, you know, I've seen lots of those patients. I'm sure you've seen lots of those patients. And then those things, like sometimes it's a great, you know, they picked the right thing for that worked for them. But more often than not, it's like, oh, I tried this thing, but it didn't work. Or I've tried supplements and they don't work. But it's not as simple as just saying I've tried a supplement, right? Like it, there's so much more to it as you went over today.
Totally. Yeah.
Please.
I mean, you know, and even like with someone with a healthy lifestyle, right? Like we talked about, so those health foundations are extremely important, but you know, when you've been dealing with something for a long time, it just might not be sufficient. So it can be really frustrating when patients come in, they're eating really well, they're moving every day, they're managing their stress, they're doing yoga, meditation, like they've got a whole, you know, health strategy going that's really positive, but they still might be dealing with something. And so it's again, a lot of it's not your fault. And it's just understanding like what might we be locked in these vicious cycles and how can we intervene with them? Right. Or how might our own individual needs not be met, where we might just need more B12 because your body just maybe just based on the conditions of your lifestyle, you need more to meet your health goals and meet your dreams. Or maybe your body just clears it more efficiently. And so you just need to add more into your body. So just different things like that.
Yeah. And even with like a healthy diet, like going back to what you were saying, that if someone might be eating like really well, eating really well can look like different things for different people, right? Like, because we do have different needs based on our lifestyle, based on our genetics, based on who we like, our physiology and our biochemistry and all of those things. And also what stage we're at in life, right? Like someone postpartum might need a completely different plan than someone before that. Or if we look at menopausal women, they're like, well, I've been eating the same, but my body is like putting on weight like no tomorrow. So mm-hmm. there's all those variations that happen. And especially if we look at nutrition research, so much of it has been done in men. And then we're translating that to women, and it doesn't work the same way. Women are women, like they're not small men. So we also have to like take all of those things into consideration, because I don't know about you, but I get a lot of women who are coming in on, especially in the last 2 years, on the keto diet. And they're like, yeah, it worked for a little bit. And then I don't know what happened, but like everything stopped working. And that's because, you know, women's physiology is completely different. And yes, there was some weight loss because A, it was a shift, and B, keto diets are generally calorically low and more satiating. However, over time, your body needs those other nutrients that were neglected in that diet. So there's so many different considerations to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And it's like there, it definitely is no one size fits all for diet. And I think you and another one of our colleagues both had good results with your PCOS. So same condition. And for you, it was moving to a plant-based diet. And for her, it was going from vegetarian to eating meat again. And so you look at that and you're like, well, what's the perfect diet for PCOS? There is none. It's about your own body and what its needs are. And you have different physiology and different needs. And so it's worth exploring different things and working with someone that can help you pinpoint, you know, how the effects of things that you're eating might be impacting your health and help you realize and make those connections.
Yeah, absolutely. So Talia, I have one question for you, which is, like I mentioned before, we're doing this interview during COVID-19. How are you taking care of yourself? How are you taking care of your mood? Because there's been lots of different moods that we've been experiencing, right? From anxiety to despair and depression to happy and joyful and grateful and everything in between. What are you doing for yourself and how are you taking care of yourself?
Yeah, I think my biggest challenge has been to get back into routines and to, I think a lot of us have been actually moving through the stages of grief, and I didn't recognize it as such, but, and so one of the last stages is acceptance and just how does this new way of living, require me to change my routines in a different way? And, you know, as social beings, it can be difficult to shift from those like more superficial, like, interactions that actually feed us, right? Like the conversation with someone at the coffee shop, the conversation with someone in your office, the fact that our work is on a routine. And so we would all take lunch at the same time, to then trying to establish more specific routines, for the current circumstances. So that's been a big one for me, is waking up at a certain time, having mealtime scheduled, having goals for the day. But the biggest thing for me has been getting outside and being in nature. And, you know, there are different thoughts around that. Everyone has a different comfort level when it comes to, you know, the risk, the potential risk exposure. But I think, you know, and we also just don't know a lot when it comes to, it's a new virus, right? So we're still gathering data when it comes to like what behaviors may expose you to a risk of infection or transition. But I think as long as you can maintain your 6-foot distance and come home, wash your hands, take all the precautions necessary, wear masks, that being outside is so essential to our health and well-being. And so no matter the weather, I'm getting outside. I also have a dog, so it makes it a lot easier. And I also feel comfortable. I mean, sometimes it's easier to meet the needs of someone that we're caring for than our own needs. So having a pet can be really helpful for like, well, he's got to go out, and it just kind of keeps you on that rhythm. But being outside in nature has been one of the main things that's kept me going during this time. And it's one of the things I'm encouraging people to do. And the other thing is Zoom interactions or WhatsApp or like face-to-face video conferencing with people, setting up dates with people online. So whether we're drinking wine together, having a coffee in the morning together, or even eating our dinner together, you know, the way that I might go and visit someone in their house, I'm trying to schedule Zoom face-to-faces, because, you know, we don't necessarily need to social distance. It's about physical distancing. And so the more we can keep those connections alive, the better. And so I'm running a 5-day meditation challenge. I have two challenges going. A cortisol cure challenge, which is about regulating our hormonal systems with regards to stress. So using lifestyle to help our stress response, get better sleep, feel more energy. That's a 5-day challenge with 5 days worth of videos, short videos to just explain the different tasks. And then a 5-day meditation challenge based on the request of my online community. And so that is 5 specific meditations, helping people, no matter what your level is, whether you have a meditation practice already or you're just getting started, or just shift you into a daily practice. They're about 15 to 20 minutes, you know, and with lots of coaching around, you know, shifting positions. So it's not something that you need to be advanced to try at all. And with that meditation challenge, I have a little bonus challenges built in. Just small self-care strategies that people can implement if they want to. Things like, let's do a media detox today, like as best you can. Maybe it's not appropriate for you to totally shut everything off, but can you just maybe not look at the news most of the day? Or maybe just reserve your news exposure to 1 hour today, or things like that that can just shift our mental health and mood and make us aware of, you know, how these new circumstances are affecting our mood and mental health.
Yeah, those sound like great challenges. Your cortisol challenge I did, which was awesome. I highly recommend it. And I'll throw the links to those in the description for this video. And where else can people find you if they want to connect with you or hang out with you?
So you can find me on Instagram, Dr. Talia ND. And I have a Facebook community called The Good Mood Project. And we can put links up for that, where you can access different videos, different resources, and things like that.
Absolutely. And I'm part of that that group, and I love it. Talia, as you can tell from this interview, is full of wisdom, and I love talking to her. She's also a good friend of mine.
Yeah. And I have a video with Anne on my page.
That's true.
And Instagram. Yeah.
All right. So I'll throw the links to those. Talia, thanks so much for being here. Thank you for sharing all your wisdom and how you approach healthcare and all that information on mood and the intricacies of the hormones. So happy we were able to do this.
Yeah, thanks, Anne. This is a lot of fun.